years of exemplary life left will be history. My house is the perfect house for smaller families you're supposedly trying to serve, and will be torn down by a rapacious, small-time developer. He will have paid over $400,000 for the lot since he demolished the house. The back of the envelope calculation says he has to sell it, the housing on the lot, for $1.2 million. How is this affordable on any stretch of the imagination? The Orwellian nature of this rhetoric is amazing. The market will never build affordable housing, no matter how much you pervert the term. We're now up to 80%, 100% of median income. This is ridiculous. On the right, no one is entitled to employment as a small contractor. And don't subsidize their profits by changing the rules to make demolition more worthwhile. On the left, no one is entitled to move into my neighborhood, just as I am not entitled to live in the West Hills or Alameda or Irvington or Eastmoreland, just because I feel like it. 24 years ago, my family made the correct decision to buy a house in a depressed neighborhood, and I hope we contributed to its resurgence. We did not insist on tearing it down in order for us to live there. If you must do these things, you must make every effort to stop the demolition. Pay strict attention to the details.
Thank you.
And your help with sweating those would be appreciated. Go ahead, please.
Good evening. I'm Tamara DeRitter. I'm representing Rose City Park Neighborhood Association, and I'm a land use planner, and I work for myself out of my home. I wanted to thank you for listening to our comments last time. It was in August when we submitted our comments to BPS. And with our comments, we found out that there's a strength in internal conversions in this latest documentation. We support that, and we see that as the best way to look at increased density. We also support and encourage you to do a pilot project first before you go as far as you're looking at going, or even citywide. Board met last night. We request that you consider a 1,000-foot overlay radius instead of what is a 5-block radius. Right, this would reduce it to a 3-block radius. So just a bit smaller. Let's see how it works. Work out the kinks, and then we can expand beyond that. Also, we support the size limits on housing, but we want to see that increased to 0.7 FAR. That would allow up to 3,000 square feet on a 5,000 square foot lot. That would fit our neighborhood. That's exactly what our historic homes have. And so it would also allow for people to work at home, have a home office, build more capacity within the house itself. I live in an area that has apartments, actually. We have rooming houses. We have all sorts of stuff that's historically accepted and now is not accepted. But so we are in favor of looking at more infill, but we want it to be done within the neighborhood fabric. Also, some of your terminology, you don't allow single-family units within the opportunity overlay. This is on comp set 4. I think it's a typo, but you need to allow a single-family unit within that zone or within the overlay, and also have it allowed on 2.5 zoned lots. And also, we wanted to encourage keeping the parking requirements for parking and allow parking pads. You don't have to have a garage. But when you have, these narrow lots, people do need to park. And if you can put it behind the house, that's great. But just allowing a parking pad is not something that is in the code right now.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank
you.
Next are Gary Whitehill-Basiuk, Brian Hochhalter, Deborah Hochhalter. They'll be followed by Jake Antlis, Dan Jaffe, and Gene O'Malley.
Good evening. Welcome.
Hi. My name is Brian Hochhalter. I was born in Portland. I've lived in the Richmond neighborhood for 22 years. And I want to thank the council for taking on an extra testimony. I appreciate that. So a legitimate problem is declared a crisis, which in turn ignites a populist movement fueled by exaggerated claims, and then an untested experiment is forced upon us. As a Richmond resident, I and many of my neighbors feel trumped by the RIP process so far. The truth of the matter is that nobody in this room really knows how the proposals would play out if implemented, and we need to get it right. Reacting in crisis mode will surely yield uncountable, unintended consequences. I would like to declare my support of the tenets outlined in the RIPSAC minority document dated November 4th, RIPSAC 7, Neighborhood Building and Neighborhood Context, which, in my opinion, offers the most coherent reckoning I have read so far. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Debbie Hochalter. I'm his wife, and I'll admit it. Having attended numerous residential infill open houses, I still have strong concerns about unintended consequences that might occur if the proposed changes in zoning goes forward. One is that it is pitting neighbors against neighbors and renters against homeowners, now termed the owning class by some, which really shocks me because I never thought of myself as being part of the ownership class. And younger residents against older. It's really unfortunate. According to the 2035 comprehensive plan, adequate space for infill already exists within the urban growth boundary, just perhaps not in the desirable neighborhoods. Can we not incentivize developers to build in neighborhoods that really need walkable access to resources rather than further stress the neighborhoods that already are complete? I'm not sure that the majority of residents in the city understand the implications of such a far-reaching zone change. The language and visuals in the presentations and survey should have been in layman's terms with actual photographs in context to show examples of how it will actually look if these changes occur on a property adjacent to your home or apartment building. The details are so very complex and confusing for the general populace. An example of this is the term large lots, which is particularly alarming because that is actually a standard city lot. Who knew? I didn't know that. I had no idea. We really don't know the outcome in terms of short-term rentals, demolition, increases or decreases, incentives for institutional buyers or stresses on infrastructure, gardens, open space, tree canopy, pedestrian and bike safety and pollution. We don't know the density goals per neighborhood. It's been a rushed process, and I would encourage the City Council to let the comprehensive plan settle in and see where we lie from there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you both.
We have six more.
Okay.
Jake Entless, Dan Jaffe, Gene O'Malley, and they'll be followed by Dan Miller, Garland Winsong, and Rebecca Hamilton.
Good afternoon or evening. My name is Jake Antles, and I hail from Coley neighborhood. And I just wanted to mention something that seems obvious to me, but people aren't talking about it, and it might be only loosely relevant, so whatever. I support the Portland for Everyone proposal as far as that goes, but in this world where we have a lot of people feeling alienated from their communities, especially in large cities across this country, maybe looking at the Pacific Coast as a possible sanctuary or a safe haven. I think that the population estimate put out by PSU is conservative, and we might see a huge, much larger number of people moving to this area, and especially with climate change and potential for large populations in the East Coast being subjected to hurricanes and other natural disasters. I think we should look at our proposals in the context of kind of the what if we do see massive population increases and especially populations don't have a whole lot of equity moving to our communities. And minority communities, I had room of white people here, right? And so thinking about equity concerns and minority populations and going for the worst case scenario or a little bit of a larger case scenario than the PSU has estimated is my recommendation. And I, as a person, as a renter, without a whole lot of possibilities of affording a $400,000 house, I really would love the idea of moving into internal conversion and living with a wonderful little intentional community of people that want to support me and I want to support them in that endeavor. So would like to prepare notes next time, but I appreciate you hearing me out on that one.
I know. I appreciate that. Thank you. Welcome.
Mayor Hales and commissioners, my name is Dan Jaffe. I live in the King neighborhood, and I'm not affiliated with any of the organized groups that have spoken today, just a citizen. I want to begin by saying that I do support allowing and increasing multi-unit housing in all Portland neighborhoods. However, the question is how that added density should be achieved and what form those added units should take. While I support the reductions in maximum house size, I'm strongly opposed to the housing overlay zone in the current proposal. I feel this proposal is an overreaching approach that really represents a massive deregulation of Portland's housing market. When I've shown the maps of the overlay to my neighbors in King, they've been quite stunned. They had no idea that such a mass rezoning was being considered. And I feel it's worth saying that the King Neighborhood Association position does not represent their position or my own. I'm concerned that a lot of the discourse in this debate has sort of implied that those who are opposed to the wholesale rezoning are opposed to fairness. I take my position because of my commitment to economic and social justice and affordability. My opposition is not motivated by a desire to protect property values, keep renters out, or maintain a homogeneous neighborhood. Quite the contrary. This proposal would significantly increase the already high displacement of vulnerable working-class families and families of color from King and many other neighborhoods. I know the council has asked folks who are opposed to this to present some alternatives, so I'll close by offering four suggestions for how we could achieve substantial added housing supply without increasing demolitions. One, allow and promote internal conversions of existing homes by owners everywhere in the city. Two, and including additions to smaller existing homes where appropriate. Two, incentivize increasingly and promote ADUs across the city. Three, I think I would also favor providing an exemption to allow new construction of duplexes in single-family neighborhoods, but only for qualified nonprofit housing organizations who will create permanently affordable units. So to close, I think this current proposal is too hasty and goes too far. It's a backdoor rezoning of the whole city to adopt what I think is an untried and untested approach. I would urge the commissioners to slow down, do a trial run, and give existing homeowners more flexibility to add new units to existing homes to address the need for housing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Jean O'Malley. I live in Laurelhurst. I've lived there for 30 years. And I agree with, while I am in favor of affordable housing, my two of my children who are in their 30s still live at home because they can't find affordable housing in Portland. So I understand the need for it. But the way the current structuring and rezoning is, the housing overlay, looking at that, if you cut the swath around Cesar Chavez, which that is the width that is proposed in that housing overlay, you essentially take half the area of Laurelhurst and put it into your housing overlay. Basically, if you allow substantial changes in that area, you have to really consider preserving the architectural heritage that we have in that area. I think that encouraging internal conversions, which I'm all in favor of, where you can do it, and certainly a lot of the Laurelhurst homes are large enough to do that, but you have to discourage demolition. There have to be actual penalties for demolition. And I don't see that anywhere in your proposal. There have been lots of demolitions and rebuildings in the area. I haven't seen any affordable housing go in when the houses in Laurelhurst are demolished. Basically, you have to consider the profit motive. I mean, the developers have very strong profit motives, and the proposal has to be structured so that there isn't a profit in just demolishing and rebuilding the same large houses that you had before.
Thank you.
Can I ask you a question? The price of single-family homes is going way up because of demand.
Yes.
And individual homeowners are selling their own homes at a huge profit. Do you think that we should limit the profit that single-family homeowners should be able to make on their houses?
I don't know how you would go about doing that.
Not either.
But theoretically, I'm just curious. Because, I mean, that's part of the housing affordability crisis, too. Simply people selling their own homes for whatever price they can get.
Yeah. I think that if you limit the ability to demolish the home, if you eliminate the profit motive on the part of the buyers, the pricing will take care of itself.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you all very much. We have some others, Sue?
Dan Miller, Garland Woodsong, and Rebecca Hamilton.
Okay, come on up. Anyone else? Okay, you two might get the last word.
First?
Whatever order you'd like.
My name is Rebecca Hamilton, and I live at 8026 North Seward Avenue. I'm here to advocate for the residential infill project and the allowance of smaller, more affordable housing choices that it provides. 2016 will be my 10-year anniversary of being a Portlander and my first year of being a homeowner. I really wish that I bought that house when I first got here, but as a 23-year-old just starting out in the workforce, that wasn't an option. Instead, I found housing in the kinds of places that many young people depend on. I lived in an ADU above someone's attic in Multnomah Village. I lived in a duplex off of Hawthorne, and in the years that I was putting myself through more school at Portland State, I lived with roommates in one unit of a giant house in Northwest that had been subdivided into four different units. None of these places could be legally built today, but they allowed me to live affordably, close to my work and school during times when I could never have afforded to rent a whole house or even a standalone apartment. And these small, affordable, illegal places are what enabled me to save enough money over the course of that 10 years to buy my little house in North Portland. My home is small, but it has a big backyard, and I know that when I'm ready to move, it would be a lot more valuable to demolish my little house and replace it with a McMansion. Someone on my street did that with their lot, and they're selling the new single house for $500,000 in North Portland. But approval of the residential infill project would let me develop a small second unit on the back of my existing unit, or even an ADU in the backyard. There could be two affordable homes that fit gently into the scale of my neighborhood instead of one giant unaffordable one. This is what I'd prefer to do with my property. I'd like that option. So I'd encourage you to approve the residential infill project, and I'd encourage you to also not require off-street parking as it drives up the prices of units. Please give people the option of incurring this expense. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Whoever would like to go next, ma'am?
Oh, hi, my name's Lucy Shelby. I live in the Hollywood neighborhood, and I've been a Portland resident since 1994. The first house I bought was in 94 over in the boys' neighborhood, and when it's sold, somebody will develop it or tear it down and develop something else there. Unless I can figure out how to get my neighbors together and we can do one of those nice little cluster cottages over there, because it's a flag unit and everybody around me, I think, probably has a flag. So it would be a great place for another pilot project. But I did do a pilot project because I bought a large Craftsman bungalow about 10 years ago in the Hollywood neighborhood, and it was permitted in the planning department as a duplex or a triplex, and but not in the building department. So I moved in, and silly me decided I'd actually try and meet all the regulations to make it a triplex. Well, that cost me probably an extra $75,000 to $100,000 because of fire. And I had to put it in a 2-inch, and I didn't know any better than to say, egad, no, stop, just keep it a duplex. I turned it into a triplex, but I have a 2-inch fire line and hoses all over what would have been my lovely attic space. So I have, and in this house, I go into this in the paper, and I have actually, right now, I have a one-bedroom and a pretty large one-bedroom, which two first-year teachers live. The studio has a guy that works at New Seasons. And my basement is full. It has a single mom with three kids. And I live on sort of the main floor. So actually, I have four units now. We won't tell anybody else that.
And, your secret's safe with us.
Yeah,
oh, it's not a secret.
Right. Only us and
just us and cable, you know.
Yeah, right. So, you know, somebody will come around and knock on the door, I suppose. But anyway, I've been very happy doing that. I bought it because I like the idea of being, at the time, I liked the idea of being a landlord. But really, I'm 71. I like Portland. I plan to age in place. And right now I'm serving a population with rents that are not exactly affordable, but they're not the most outrageous around either. And if somebody could incentivize me, I could even lower them. And I really actually would like, and I'm not sure exactly how you do that, but I actually would like when the people who move out of the basement, I'd like to put another, like, single mom in there with a couple of kids or a parent with a couple of kids because it's really large enough for that. I have backyard space still. I still have a two-car garage that I'd like to turn into a accessible unit.
Before you continue on down the path that you're going here.
That's very helpful, and that's a great case study, so thank you.
Yeah, and an accessible unit, because I've already put in the, because my partner before he left for Ohio had an amputated leg, I've already put in some ramp kinds of things, yeah, and so I've already started on that. And I'm hopeful that this proposal will actually allow me to do it. Because as I look at the floor area ratios now, all that kind of stuff, I could actually pop the roof of the house I'm living in and still, not that I have any time to do that. I'd rather go to Europe or Africa before I do that.
You're obviously a creative and energetic person.
Right.
We appreciate you
it
being
gives
here.
Me,
Thank you.
It gives me a little bit of excitement to keep on going with all
I'm
that.
Excited just listening to you, or maybe tired. I'm not sure which. Thank you very much. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm Garland Woodsong. I sat on the Residential Infill Stakeholders Committee. I'm the Land Use Chair for Concordia Neighborhood Association. I just wanted to walk you through a quick presentation, a lightning talk, if you will. As you know, our city is changing and the average household size is dropping, which means that our unit sizes should also be dropping in terms of new construction to keep up with demand. And of course, people increasingly want to live in a walkable neighborhood. However, supply is not keeping up with demand. Since the recession, multifamily 5-plus buildings have bounced back. Single-family housing units have bounced back, but the missing middle housing type has not rebounded since the recession. So supply is not keeping up with demand when it comes to missing middle housing types. Indeed, we have what people are calling a demolition epidemic, but most of the time, after a single-family house is demolished, another single-family house is built to replace it, and that's because of the limitations in the existing zoning code, as you know. So staff has proposed to regulate using floor area ratio, which is the total floor area of a structure that's habitable legally over the total land area of the parcel. However, the proposal of 0.5 FAR is too low for our dense urban neighborhoods. That is a suburban FAR. That is not an urban FAR. And the Johnson report has shown that such a low FAR will actually drive down unit construction over the next 30 years. Rather, we should be looking at an FAR of 0.9, which is more appropriate for Portland's dense urban neighborhoods, or at least finding a way to get there, perhaps with a combination of density bonuses. Also, I want to touch on what is progressive. So if Portland is a progressive city, is it progressive to be a NIMBY, not in my backyard? No, it is not progressive to be in favor of economic or racial segregation. finally, we have recommended a form-based code as a way to regulate our residential zones. I believe that a form-based code is something we need to take a strong look at. I think it could address a lot of these concerns over residential compatibility and the differences between the neighborhoods that are papered over by just calling it all R5. Cincinnati has an excellent form-based code. I would recommend taking a look at that and looking at how we might be able to use the residential single-family zoning code update as a way to test drive a form-based code in Portland. This would be a great way to preserve neighborhood character while allowing flexibility in housing types. it's very important that we get to at least 4 legal units. The current staff proposal only gets us to 3 and only on corners. But if you look at the any possible way the market could deliver affordable units, we have to get at least 2-4 units before the market can deliver something that an MFI household might be able to afford.
Did you wrap up?
No, so if we can allow 8, we double the affordability. So strongly consider making a tweak to this proposal that will allow the market to deliver more affordable units by allowing at least 4 units. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for your work on this task force.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Okay, so we have a little energy and time left for discussion. I'd like to bring our staff back up, and maybe I'll start out. We've all got some more homework to do, obviously a great deal of excellent testimony, a lot of stuff that we still that I still want to read, and I know my colleagues do as well. But if I might, I'll go ahead and start off with some reflections from my perspective and open that up to you two, and then we can get into specifics. So I've divided what I was writing in my notes into facts, opinions, and notions. So let me start with the facts. Well, first of all, I just want to say that this hearing, like all hearings on land use in our city, is very heartening. Because, I mean, where else could you have this many people that cared and would get into this level of detail, even if we don't always agree? So that's to be celebrated. However, there's some things I found frustrating about this this discussion, and I'll ventilate about those as we go along. One fact that I had to get on the table right away, which is that we're going to leave the record open until the 23rd of November, right? Is that the date? That's what someone suggested to me anyway, so that we can get more... Is that right?
Right. That's the Wednesday right before Thanksgiving?
Yeah. So that people can provide additional information or copies of what you presented tonight or anything else. So here's some facts. One, 1,000 people a month are moving to Portland. And I take Jake's point about the fact that the election plus climate refugees might make that a low number, as scary as that is. But 1,000 people a month are moving to Portland. Two, mom, dad, and the kids are less than 25% of the typical households, and that's falling. Three, we had the highest housing price increase in the country of any major city year over year, 2015 to 2016. Four, here's some of the frustration. While we've been talking about this during my term as mayor, we've lost 700 houses to demolition. While we've been talking about this. So some people are saying that there's no urgency. Sorry, don't agree with that. I feel a great deal of urgency on this deconstruction, I'm sorry, on this demolition issue. Yes, we approved the deconstruction requirement, happy about that, although it's just a first step. No one seemed to like my demolition tax idea very much, including my own neighborhood. Fine, I'm looking for every idea I can lay my hands on to reduce the rate of destruction. And that was one of the original impetuses for this work and remains so for me and I bet for everybody on this council. So make no mistake about that. There's going to be no version of this that I am interested in supporting that won't reduce the rate of demolition. It must achieve that goal, among others. And then finally, the other fact is that after the demolition, and Garland just showed us the statistics again, most of those demolished houses were replaced by houses, and a lot of them have been out of scale with the prevailing design types of their neighborhoods. So I think those are all facts. Now some opinions and some perspectives. I was particularly taken by Roberta's story because I moved to Portland as a 23-year-old. Got my first entry-level job at 122nd and Stark, paying $12,000 a year. My wife got a job as a secretary at PGE. When we were 24, bought our starter house, a 5-bedroom fixer-upper in Kearns, 2 blocks from Laurelhurst, for $60,000. Had our first child in that house at age 25. My kids are not living that life. And neither are all the young people that we've heard from in this discussion. I mean, I don't think I heard anybody under 40 who came in here and said, yeah, I'm making so much money, I bought my first house right out of the gate when I moved to Portland. It's a struggle for young people to buy homes. And I think all of us have been struck by a bit of a generational divide in this room during this discussion. And it's not pitting people against each other. It's our kids. It's my kids, too. Some of them are still here living in shared housing. Second perspective, no urgency, go slow. We've been working on this particular proposal for a year, and it's not going to be done when this council in the next few weeks gives direction to staff. It's going to be going into the very legislative process that people have requested. So if that constitutes going fast, I find that discouraging because I think we need to go faster. There have been a number of, another thing I didn't find the go slow plea persuasive, frankly. I think we actually need to go faster. Another thing I didn't find persuasive, although I'm interested in customization, is that, oh, we shouldn't do something citywide. We're already doing something citywide. R5 is citywide. The A overlay that became the ADU policy is citywide. Doesn't mean it's the only way to do it, but we're operating in a citywide zoning code today. And we have done things citywide that haven't been equally needed in every neighborhood. We banned gated entry development citywide. It's not necessarily an issue in every neighborhood, but we banned it citywide. We banned snout houses citywide. And I was involved in both of those planning decisions, and I'm very proud of both of them. But truth is, those threats were different in different neighborhoods. So those are some thoughts and perspectives. Now, some issues that I've heard here that I'm going to want to have more discussion with staff about. One is, looking at the list of what we're doing in this, limiting the house size, lowering the roof line, and tuning the setbacks. Not absolutely sure we've got it right yet, but I think we're shrinking the envelope, but I need to hear from the advocates on both sides of this discussion. So if 2,500 is not right, what is? Give me a number. Not now, but give me one real soon. Because somewhere in there is the Goldilocks point, maybe. Secondly, there have been a number of suggestions, actually from people on various points in this debate, about even stronger incentives for internal conversions, even stronger protection for existing building preservation. I'm interested in those issues. So in terms of tuning this, again, back to what I said at the outset of this hearing, it's either adopt it as is, throw it away, or tune it. I'm interested in tuning it, and I want to make sure that the preservation incentives and disincentives for demolition are strong enough that we get one of my intended outcomes when we started in this process, which is to reduce the rate of demolition of worthwhile older Portland structures. So Brandon and others, I'll need some more help on that issue. This issue that was raised tonight of exceptions and adjustments in unique areas, like Mike Dowd's situation, in South Portland, interested in that. I'm not sure quite how to do it. I'm very intrigued by Terry Dublinsky-Milton's suggestion about seismic upgrades. Not sure if we can pull that off right away, but I'm very interested in that. I'm not a big fan of flag lots, so I'm not sure about where we are in this proposal with respect to that. Then how do we customize this? Is it possible to customize this more to the particulars of neighborhoods than we have so far? Maybe with FAR, maybe with something else. I know South Burlingame is different than Buckman. I get that. We also have a citywide zoning code, again, that has to work in the real world. So those are some issues. Again, this is a little bit of a stream of consciousness, or I'm not sure if it's consciousness after the day that we've had in this room, but those are some of the issues that I want to explore further in discussion with staff and with my colleagues, and again, to hear more from you on. So my overall perspective is, again, looking at these seven concepts, yes, we should limit the size of houses. Yes, one of the things we should do is lower the roof line and improve the setbacks. More housing types. Again, it's not just about affordability, it's about diversity of opportunity. Again, all these first-time buyers and other household types that aren't mom and dad and two kids that need 1,900 square feet. We haven't talked a lot about, have we done enough for cluster development? We heard some testimony from Eli and some others about that. And again, I would change the wording in number 7 from provide flexibility for retaining existing homes to provide strong incentives / disincentives for the purpose of retaining existing homes. Because I'm not just interested in giving people the option of preserving. I want to have a very strong force pushing in that direction. So those are some of the topics that I want to talk about more, and I'll shut up and let my colleagues reflect some if they're willing and able.
I am generally in favor of the proposal as drafted. I would characterize my position as let her rip, or in the spirit of Bill Shonley, rip city, all right. And I think that it might be worth considering some modifications. Actually, I might lean towards Mr. Woodsong's proposal of increasing allowable FAR. But I think that this is the right direction. I want to talk a little bit about the issue of affordability. Some folks have said that new duplexes are not going to be affordable to people below 80% MFI, and that might be right. But the way things are going in the city, I'm worried that homes won't be affordable to anybody below 700% of MFI. My house is now, which my wife and I bought 4 years ago, has gone from the $375,000 we paid for it to, according to Zillow, $555,000. My wife and I make a very good living. We couldn't afford our own house. So market forces are driving up the cost of housing. And the market for houses, like any other market, if you constrain the supply, then you increase the price. If we allow for more supply, the prices won't increase so much. If we limited the number of restaurants that could be built in Portland, then the price of restaurant food would go up. So I think, and also I do ideologically maybe want more density. I want more people living in Portland as opposed to Houston, where they have no constraints on building at all, because living in Portland is more energy efficient than living in Houston because you don't have to run air conditioning all the time. So from a climate perspective, I'd rather have people living here. We have a moderate climate and some commitment to transit than living in Houston. I also wanted to note that it's important to remember that we don't hear from a representative segment of society in these hearings any more than we're all that necessarily representative of ourselves. We hear from people who are passionate enough and informed enough and have the time to come here. And I really appreciate, and we all appreciate, the input of the people who are passionate enough, informed enough, and have the time to come here. But I did want to share some information I have, and I've actually been meaning to share this publicly the past couple of weeks, and I just keep on forgetting, that touches on what the general population of Portland might feel about some of these issues. In my own campaign, I did a poll where you test out various things that you might want to say to voters and see if the things that you believe, the things that people agree with most. One of the questions we asked was, Novick supports limiting the size of new houses to prevent building new McMansions, which make the affordable housing crisis even worse, occupy lots that could be used for multiple homes, block views, and don't fit in with the existing character of most Portland neighborhoods. 18% of Portlanders thought that was a very convincing argument to vote for Novick. 31% thought it was somewhat convincing. 24% said not too convincing. And 20% said not at all convincing. By contrast, when we asked there's another question we asked. Novick wants high school to start a little later in the day because research shows that when teenagers are forced to wake up too early, they have a hard time learning, get into traffic crashes, and even overeat. Seattle and other cities have already successfully implemented later school start times, especially for adolescents, because the benefits are so clear and the cost to make the switch are so low. 28% found that a very convincing argument. 37% found it a somewhat convincing argument, for a total of 65%. Now, this poll was a 200 sample, so there's some significant margin of error. But based on this poll, Portlanders are more worried about high school students getting too little sleep, which I worry about, but I didn't think anybody else did, than they are about a bunch of new McMansions being built. So I think that there's some people who think that, I mean, who look at this proposal and say, it's not doing enough to preserve existing neighborhoods. But actually, if this poll is right, by limiting the size of new houses, we're doing more to preserve the character of existing neighborhoods than a lot of Portlanders really want us to do. So I think that I thought that was worth sharing. Again, I've been meaning to share it for weeks and just kept on forgetting. But I think, I mean, we need to think about what all Portlanders, current and future, would like to see and like to take advantage of. And I think that this proposal goes in the direction of making this a Portland that is open to as many people as possible. So I think, if anything, we should push it a little further. I don't think we should slow it down. Oh, one more thing I wanted to say is that I never like to speak for my colleagues or my future replacement, but I will say that Chloe Udaly, in a discussion we had at Buckman a few weeks ago, said that she'd been talking to Eli Spivak, and she is inclined to be supportive of a broad mandate for middle housing. So I don't feel like, in advocating for a broad mandate for middle housing, I'm pushing a position that will be irrelevant in 6 weeks because I won't be here anymore.
So my comments are not in any particular order. I'm sorry about that. They're written in all kinds of different orders. But I particularly liked Alyssa Eisenstein-Kroger, who said, we are in a housing affordability crisis, not a density crisis. And we all know that there's enough zoned capacity in our comprehensive plan that we just spent 6 months figuring out. There's plenty of capacity for people coming here. And actually, just to set the record straight, Oregon is a sanctuary state. The whole of the state of Oregon has the principles about encouraging people, not allowing the police to turn people over to immigration. So people actually don't have to live right in Portland in order to be able to be safe and to come, and we should be able to accommodate that. I remember when Commissioner Hales caused a firestorm both in Southwest and elsewhere when you went to Metro Policy Advisory Committee and said, we're going to take more than our fair share of density, we're going to do 70,000 units. Hue and cry, we did it. It's become an even better place to live. But we've got to remember that we've got 95 different neighborhoods, and they all have vastly different infrastructure. They have a vastly different history. You know, some of them have the old skinny lots, and in some places, like North Portland, the skinny 25 by 100s, those are the only place that new development is actually affordable, because some of the developers have found this niche of doing a relatively simple new bungalow with a, not even a bungalow, a two-story, but with the garage attached and the porch and such. They look fine, and they're actually selling for a reasonable price. Everything else, everywhere else, new construction is not going to be affordable. So to the extent that I think we do have agreement on, we have some agreement, let's put it that way, the size, the height, the setbacks, the placement of off-street parking, I think we've agreed that we all want to do something. We've heard varying opinions on whether the FARs are too much or not enough. Adding a basement and an attic, does that then give you a house which is back over 3,000 square feet? Have we even thought about how people are going to have home offices and work from home, where even if you're just one or two people, you may want to have a home business and be allowed to do that? So I think that has to be factored in. When you did the rezoning to accommodate the
2040 plan.
2040 plan, right.
Right.
And here we are in 2016 already. There was pretty much a wholesale blanket in Outer Southeast plan. It was blanketed R2 with an A overlay, which got a lot of apartments with no infrastructure, no safe crosswalks, because you've had to keep going back in that, no parks, which I'm now planning to do that. We need to, if we're going to do this, we have to make sure that we've got the infrastructure. I certainly agree that some neighborhoods, we want more people to live there because they're walkable, they've got good schools, good parks, sidewalks, you know, the amenities of urban living. And there's other neighborhoods that have none of that. And so I was just thinking when we had the testimony from Southwest Neighborhoods, if you don't have any parking off-site, you're allowing in some of the skinny lots 12 units where there currently is only one, and you don't have any parking, then you're going to have parking all along the sides of the road and people are going to have to walk in the street. So that doesn't work. That's not what we're envisioning as the goal of this infill project. So I think we do, I'm concerned about the, just because it's within a half a mile, quarter mile, whatever, of a so-called rapid transit service, the frequent transit service is just, can you get downtown? It's not, can you get from outer southeast to outer northeast or from outer northeast southeast over to Intel? I think there's some significant equity issues in terms of not everybody is able to ride a bike or ride transit. Transit doesn't necessarily go where people need to go. It may not go to their childcare provider. It may not go to their job, and they're going to need to have a car. And so as we are right now, we do have to accommodate some cars in some neighborhoods and got to figure out where they're going to go. But I do think that we could this year get to good agreements on the how to make all new development smaller. I think that's a shared concept that, of course, they can still put gold taps on it. But if it's smaller, it's not going to be as expensive as a large house with gold taps. So I think we should be able to do that. The flag lots, I agree with. I thought everything I've ever learned from planners in Portland is that we don't like flag lots. So for some of the reasons that were mentioned, so I would discourage those all along. On the skinny lots issue, I would like to know from staff where in the comp plan map that we've just finished doing after 6 months did we advise it to go to R2.5, and where did we make some other choice? We had one of the residents, I think of Southeast Harold, or something, not Harold, there was a in Southeast, mm-hmm. where we had an extensive discussion in the comp plan that we were not going to upzone to 2.5 because it was a long dead-end street and fire access and such. We made that as a positive choice. So for those folks to have to come back in and say, again, why we shouldn't have to do it, it just doesn't seem right. So I would be interested in knowing, where did we advise 2.5, and maybe we could target those particular areas for some special zoning code or overlay, but not just everywhere. And I don't think it's actually fair to staff to say, go back and refine it, because what you've got right now is really, really broad. So I don't think it's a likely expectation that you're going to be able to go lot by lot, citywide, to figure out where to even continue pursuing this. And maybe it does need to be neighborhood by neighborhood. I think we still need to look at how can we prohibit. I would like to know. Now you're telling me that we can prohibit building on vacant lots at 2,500 square feet in skinny lot areas. Again, Randy Leonard and I went round and round on this in, early 2000s, and we were told, if you've got a lot of record, the state has to, you have to be allowed to build on it. So if that's no longer the case, if we've got new city attorneys or somebody who's a later Luba decision, I would like to hear about it. But just blanket changing them all just doesn't make any sense to me. One of the big questions is home ownership versus rampant speculation by developers and by people coming in to do all of this increased density and not having anybody who's a resident homeowner. I was very glad to hear that, in fact, you can get a mortgage, which you might not be able to afford otherwise if you've got a rental property. Have we found with Airbnb that that's not the case in a lot of places, that people are having basically commercial hotels? And how are we going to both make sure that if we are allowing additional density, that there is some kind of a requirement for some somebody to be the property owner that's living there? And I don't know how that we can do that legally. If we're looking to only allow internal conversions, which I support the internal conversions, but we do then have to get to how do you define what's a demolition? And that was something that I grappled with when I was in charge of development services. I don't know that we've made any more progress on that, but it's not an internal conversion if you take out all but the foundation and start again. So we do need to have some parameters of, the external facade, the height, maybe some additional bump out at the back if it's within the allowable lot coverage. There has to be some definition of that. But I lived in Rochester, New York. My first apartment that we moved into when we got married was a studio. And we had my twin bed that was kind of a lot too small for two people. But anyway, and then it was $215 a month. And the one bedroom upstairs became available. And we had a long discussion about whether we could afford the extra $20 a month to get this one bedroom for $235, and we took the bold step of doing that, and it was really a good thing that we did. Again, like you said, those kinds of rents are not available anywhere anymore. But that particular house was, it had an elderly lady at the back with a Section 8 housing that was the studio, and then as upstairs, and it fit in the neighborhood. Only one of us had a car, at least we didn't have a car to start off with, but there was room for that. But you have to do it more carefully, I think. I don't support all of the new construction being allowed to have multiple units unless it's much more careful. I do support, as others did, the setback flexibility for trees. But again, I warn us for making an administrative nightmare for development services if they've constantly got to be averaging out what the setback is on a particular street. I mean, why does that even matter, really, whether some houses are further back and some are not? So I think that's another concern I have, is to make sure we get it right. There was a couple of really helpful suggestions on how to ensure long-term affordability in addition to making the units smaller. The non-profit idea was one that I thought might have some merit in it. But otherwise, I don't think we are. I don't support at all the requirement for doing two units if you've got a 5,000 square foot lot in an R2.5 zone. I think that's taking away the rights of the property owner if they want to do just one larger house or one medium-sized house on a 5,000 square foot lot. I don't think we should be making property owners necessarily have a second unit. I'm very concerned about the size of the required outdoor space. From memory, it's about 10 by 10, which is barely enough for a patio, for a barbecue, but not really for a swing set. And so that was something when we did the land division code rewrite in the mid-1990s, we were looking at required outdoor space and could there be a swing set as well as a patio, a barbecue. As I said, I'm sorry I'm all over the shop here. It's been a long day. But just to get back to the fundamental question, the issue of supply and demand is not it's a false equation because we're not a closed system. Anybody can come here, and people can come from San Francisco, get out of their grotty little studio apartment that cost a bunch of money, much more than mine did in New York, and buy a five-bedroomed house here because the prices elsewhere are so much higher. So to say that we have to have some more supply to meet demand, that's not going to lower the affordability. It's not going to make it more affordable, and we've really got to look at what actually is going to do that. So I think there's a lot of in this proposal that could be good, and then there's a lot that I think if we did it blanket across the city without looking specifically how it would work in this neighborhood that maybe doesn't have a grocery store, that the nearest frequent bus service is a mile or more away, I just think we're asking for trouble, and we're asking for people in existing neighborhoods to not be welcoming their neighbors if it's just so different from what they thought they were buying when they got into that neighborhood. So certainly encouraging more rentals, but to blend them into the fabric of the neighborhoods rather than just allowing them everywhere, which I think will just encourage more developer speculation, more older people getting conned out of selling their houses for pennies on the dollar and then scrape it off, put two new ones. Even if they're two small new ones, they're still going to be much more expensive than the little starter house that's being bulldozed.
I just wanted to cut a couple things. One, it's quite obvious we're not going to get a consensus because, for one thing, Commissioner Fritz and I all obviously disagree violently on how supply and demand works in the housing market. There's something I've neglected to mention earlier, which is that Commissioner Fish, a couple of weeks ago, said that it seemed to him that the overlay zone was the entire city. And I think that I've talked to BPS staff about giving more definition to what the zone is. I mean, it's development along centers and civic corridors, but also the inner ring and different housing opportunity areas. And they say that housing opportunity areas are areas that already have assets that support the health and success of the residents who live there. Walkability, transit services, quality schools and parks, and access to employment. So what I've talked to VBS staff about is developing sort of a somewhat longer description of what that means and clarifying that, no, this is not, it's not the entire city. It's segments of the city that have been chosen for a reason.
Thank you for adding that point, too, because that allowed me to look into my notes as well. The concern of accessibility and visitability, if we're going to have this kind of housing built, we should be requiring universal visitability and making a certain percentage of whether we're going to give an entitlement that's not there today, we should require that to be accessible and or low affordable. And I don't know how you're going to be able to get to the affordability because all the experience we've had is with multifamily, with tax abatements and such. Occasionally, small amounts with home buyer opportunity areas with the 10-year tax abatement. But not. That, again, is something that we've recently looked at, and we've got to figure out what's the right balance of giving up on property taxes, giving up on system development charges, knowing that the new families coming here are going to want those parks and sidewalks and all those other things too.
It occurred to me that I also have a question, which is really a legal question, which is, could we say that you can't demolish a house unless you're going to replace it with more than one unit? Can we just make that blanket statement?
Good question to pose. I won't ask her to answer it on the spot. So let me make some process suggestions. One, obviously, we've heard a lot of diversity of opinion. There's quite a bit of diversity of opinion on the council. That's okay. I believe that there is a reasonable likelihood that a significant portion of this will have a majority of support on the council to move forward. Exactly what that portion is remains to be debated. I would recommend a couple things. Again, you've heard us discuss this. You've heard your fellow citizens discuss this. Keep it coming in terms of emails and other communication with us about, okay, I heard your conversation. Here's how you resolve that issue. If it's not 2,500 square feet, what should it be? I'm looking at a couple of people in particular on that issue. So and then each of us should meet with the Planning Bureau staff as well between now and the end of the month. And then you probably have some things that you need from us in addition to that. And obviously our colleagues have not heard this discussion, but have heard a lot of the rest of it, so they're going to want to weigh in as well. But again, if the choices are stop now, it can't be done, do the whole thing as is, or do some tuning, I'm headed towards doing some tuning, but nevertheless doing something. The fact that it's this complex and that it is this difficult for a council that often reaches consensus to do so indicates how, one, that this is really important, two, that it is really complex, and whether we do a pilot project or a relatively quick checkup after whatever we enact is enacted, I think there's going to be a need to check and make sure we're not getting unintended consequences, right? We have had unintended consequences from other planning actions. We've gotten it right an awful lot of the time. But I think it's going to be pretty important to watch how this plays out, whatever this ends up being. Ms. Susan, you look like you have some thoughts.
This is just more of a process thing for people to keep in mind. Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. We've never done a process quite like this.
Yeah.
In that what we've done, I mean, we have taken a long time and done it sort of like this, but what we've done in this case is come up with a concept, and then we're going to move into the code writing, we're going to move into this other thing. So at the end of this process, you know, a few weeks from now, the end doesn't have to be that specific.
Yeah, yeah, it can
so
be general
you
direction.
You could direct us in each one of these seven concept areas to say, get it down to here, and then give us a couple of choices. And that gives you months of time. It gives us months of time to go back through the entire process, back out and take it out to the community, take out drafts, say, should it be this, should it be that? But if this just sort of, you know, we were at this level, we've kind of come down about here.
Yeah.
We've got a long way to go.
And to get all the way to the last.
Exactly. And we, in-house, you know, when we made the decision after talking to each of you a lot, you know, do we put this as a broad, you know, looking at the entire city and parts of the city? Do we look at, you know, two blocks from transit areas? Do we look at what areas do we look at? We sort of got direction, I feel, from all of you saying, put something on the table broad and that gets people's attention so that everybody's out there and talking about it and we can have this conversation.
Yeah.
If we had put something that wasn't bold at all, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
nice.
I just think it's important that we went there. We'll begin to move back, and we'll get it to a point that you can give us direction so that we can go right.
And yeah, I appreciate that. And I want to reiterate something Commissioner Novick said. It's not my desire to paint the next mayor into a corner, and it's obviously not your desire to paint your successor into a corner. And this is not going to be to a level of detail where that's going to happen in the next 6 weeks. Hopefully what happens in the next 6 weeks is, again, we give some direction to the Bureau. I believe you should keep going, do this, this, and this, change that, and that. Well, you know, again, we may not get to a complete agreement about that level of detail. But this is not going to get resolved this year. But, again, I want to go back to one of my earlier comments. To say that we have the luxury of time in a city that's having our housing crisis, this kind of in-migration, and this terrible gap of opportunity for young people that want to have housing choices other than a great big apartment building or being the fourth offer in a line, you know, for a house they're not going to get to buy, that's not acceptable to me. And going slow in that situation, I don't think is the morally responsible thing to do. So I don't think we should go too fast. We should, you know, we should measure twice, cut once. But I think we should cut nevertheless.
I might just comment.
Please.
if we're going to be giving something that there's not there now, we've got to make sure that we get something back for it.
Yeah.
And we can't give it and then take it away because that doesn't work. But
right.
I think we all agree that we'd like to not have 700 demolitions in the next 4 years as we have had in your 4 years. I think we've all agreed that we'd like smaller housing, that we would like a measure of affordability, that we actually agree that we're fine with different family units living.